The Athletic FC Podcast Network.
Flank. Isak, Kimmerich, Hall well advanced from fullback, in by Lewis Hall, Isak! In next to no time, silences the Stretford end, and spreads the Magpie wings. Run through Bruno Kimmerich, and the Kimmerich has played a beautiful ball here for Isak, and Isak is direct. But then he went eyeball to eyeball with Onana, and he simply fed in the ball.
What was that?
Kimmerich, Gordon, Hasraoui in reverse. Gordon taunting him. Dashing in to double Newcastle United's lead is John Linton.
Cross came from Hall on the first goal. This time it's from Anthony Gordon. It's a beautiful delivery.
Takes some dispossessing. John Linton. Tonali. Kimmerich. Gordon. Tonali! Against the post and out, they more or less walked it in.
I mean, they're having the time of their lives out there, Newcastle.
I'm Taylor Payne, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time podcast, brought to you by The Athletic FC. We're all in a jolly good mood, and I'm here with George Colgan. George, you all right?
I'm on Fantasy Island. I'm dreamland. Can't believe it.
It's great, isn't it?
Crest of a wave.
What a winterval.
It's been astonishing. Blimey, Newcastle winning at Old Trafford, it just doesn't happen. I mean, it doesn't happen since last season, when I saw it happen then.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But this was different, wasn't it? I mean, it was... thinking about this last night, that League Cup match last season, I was in the away end for that. It was absolutely hilarious. But it was sort of hilarious in a no-context way. Everyone was like kind of laughing. Eddie Howe picked about 9 fullbacks and Newcastle still won.
That's right.
And it was hilarious.
Yeah.
But last night, my God, that was just something else, wasn't it? It was just...
mad.
I'm just not used to seeing them be so bad and Newcastle be so good at all.
Doesn't happen, does it?
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Chris Watts here as well. Chris, how are you doing? On cloud 9, are you?
I am, indeed. I mean, possibly the only person who, other than George Colgan, who has more of a
natural pessimistic and negative outlook to life involving Newcastle United is John Anderson, the former defender and BBC Newcastle commentator. And I actually gave him a lift home last night. And even he was on top of the world after seeing the performance. I mean, there was obviously bits of negativity within there because it's Ando and that's how he operates, mainly about how abysmal Man United were, but he obviously was taking merriment in that as everyone else did.
He was taking merriments.
Murrayments, yeah. I didn't offer him any sweets either, actually. A bit of a bad host right there in sense of...
Just put it in the services, Chris, so I can get some Murrayments.
I like a Murrayment.
Lovely sweets. Underrated.
But yes, I've done that journey a heck of a lot. And obviously last year, when there was the Carabao Cup game, George was my chauffeur for the game when he forgot his ticket. And that was hilarious. Yes.
Yeah, I forgot my ticket.
But actually in the league, was there when Newcastle went 2-0 up when Jose Mourinho was in charge and still found a way to lose 3-2 when there was the time Matty Longstaff scored and they lost 4-1. Quite a few times they've taken the lead at Old Trafford and thrown it away, but thankfully not to be denied.
Yoshinori Muto as well?
I think that was the 3-2 against Mourinho, I think. That was Ronaldo's return game, I think.
Mm. There you go. Well, we are, as we said, having a wonderful Christmas time, but we have to say Happy New Year to everybody as well. We are recording this on New Year's Eve. This is what we do with our lives, each of us, on New Year's Eve. We're not going to mad parties and all sorts of rock and roll excess. We are sitting in our bedrooms recording podcasts for you lovely people. But we have to say Happy New Year, and it's 2025 if you listen to this tomorrow. So,
yeah, just on that, most podcasts you listen to they're recording it on New Year but they actually have recorded it like 3 weeks ago. But we generally don't have lives, and this is New Year generally.
Exactly.
I mean, you say we're just sitting around doing the podcast, but I mean, we are all wearing Lederhosen.
Very true. Yeah, and nothing else. Just later, wasn't it? Right then, that's it. Expected to win at Old Trafford. That doesn't happen very often, does it? But we did so in dominant fashion. That first half hour, Chris, was magnificent, wasn't it?
It was. I was chatting to George about this earlier, and I think that there were similarities in terms of towards the start of the year, one of the first matches of the year when Newcastle went to the Stadium of Light. People who in North East football who cover both clubs and watch Sunderland regularly were saying how, well, Newcastle will win because Newcastle are a better side. And until you actually saw Newcastle against Sunderland, until I saw that, it was hard to sort of fully comprehend and believe that.
Yeah.
Everyone was telling me how abysmal Man United were. Everyone in the press box and in the press room at Old Trafford was saying they're rubbish. There's absolutely no way that Man United can win this game. And you're sort of thinking, yeah, but there's that weight of history that Newcastle have. And also this is Man United. And regardless of the way that they've sort of formed, there is still that weight behind the name and their sort of pedigree as a football club. And yet the first half an hour was just stark that it was one very, very good team against one very, very crap team. And Newcastle made Man United look crap, but also Man United were crap. And I think that it was just a team. Every single area of the pitch, Newcastle were far better in. Just there wasn't a single position where you would, after the first 15 minutes, have said, Newcastle would be better if they had that Man United player in that position. Every single player was better. I mean, midfield, as we'll come on to, was the real difference point.
Yeah.
Alongside Alexander Isak, obviously, up front. But Newcastle were just a far better team. And that is what is brilliant to see, because certainly in the Premier League era, that just really very rarely, if ever, has happened, where Newcastle have gone to Old Trafford and just have clearly, definitively a far better side.
There is a sort of degree of brain retraining that needs to happen, because it's not like we've not seen Newcastle beat Man United. As I say, it happened at Old Trafford last season in the League Cup, but then the league game comes around right at the end of the season. Mm. Newcastle had kind of recovered from their injury nightmare. They were pushing for Europe, pushing for seventh place. And of course, you know, they lose at Old Trafford. It's a very, very familiar feeling. I mean, I'm like Chris, except older. It's just, I've just got automatic. You go to Old Trafford. What do you expect? You expect to see Newcastle get turned over. And seeing Newcastle as the bookies' favourites last night was kind of like, that's not real. That's not going to happen.
And it's crazy, isn't it?
Man U are just they're just the opponents who have that bogey team relationship with us. They have the Indian sign over us. It's always them. It was always them, you know. It was them in the League Cup final a couple of seasons ago. It was them at the end of last season. Newcastle finished above them for the first time in the Premier League. And then Man United beat Man City in the FA Cup final. and getting to Europe, and just seeing Newcastle so dominant, so composed and electrifying, like in that first half an hour, was just brilliant to see, and such a strange thing to see. And, you know, at the same time, Chris was there, I was watching the telly, hearing Gary Neville say Newcastle are hammering Man United.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just absolutely astonishing. And they were so much better.
He called Man United pound for pound the worst team in the league as well, didn't he? Which I thought was quite telling.
Yeah. Difficult to argue with him.
It is.
But I mean, just to sort of hammer home the point about Newcastle's record at Old Trafford, because in the Premier League era, certainly Newcastle have some poor away records at certain grounds. Anfield, obviously Stamford Bridge, their record isn't very good. The Emirates, their record is not very good. But at Old Trafford, it isn't even just a Premier League phenomenon. It isn't even just the time that Man United were brilliant under Sir Alex Ferguson. Bookended on that side is still Newcastle's terrible record. So in the Premier League era, before last night, Newcastle had gone to Old Trafford 29 times, lost 19, drew 9, and won only once when Yohan Gabay scored in December 2013. Now, I have to just correct my earlier stat. Yoshinori Muto actually scored in 2018. It wasn't the Ronaldo game, just to correct myself. Right. But then, if you extend the timescale back further, back to 1972, Newcastle had visited Old Trafford 39 times, lost 28 in the league, drawn 10, and there was still just that single Yohan Gabay victory. So it's a fascinating one, because Howe was asked about it before the game, and he said, when you get a statistic like that, you want to change it, but this is a unique match. And that's what all of these, you get everyone who say that this is a different team. Why should it be that these sort of statistics weigh heavily? But it has weighed heavily. It's too coincidental for Newcastle over that long period of time to have gone to Old Trafford and had such a terrible record. There is something psychological about it, and as good and dominant as Man United were under Sir Alex Ferguson, this was something which was a millstone around Newcastle United's neck. So that is part of the reason why this is just such a historic and momentous moment, really, for Newcastle. And it feels, psychologically, it feels massive. That's what Eddie Howe said as well. He said he was talking both about this and about Newcastle going to a ground like this and delivering a performance like this. Because maybe that's the one thing you can say during the Eddie Howe era. Yes, they've gone to Spurs, but they haven't gone to the other sort of big teams and actually won. Now, I know Man United are mired in potentially a relegation battle as their manager said, but still, the fact that there was this psychological hold over them going to Old Trafford and to have managed to push through that, I think it just felt huge.
I have to say, I don't think there's a team I enjoy beating more, with the exception of Sunderland, maybe, than Man United. I think, you know, there's a lot of unprocessed trauma from the years, which is all bottled up.
Yeah,
and
we owe them.
And we owe them massively, don't we? The 90s, so, you know, many. All of that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feels great.
They've been an absolutely brilliant team, you know, particularly in the 90s. Even in these years of struggle for them, they've still managed to kind of win cups. Yeah. And obviously they beat us in the League Cup as well. So all these things are relative. But no, you've just got to absolutely embrace it, enjoy it, take it for what it is for Newcastle purposes, for the purposes of Newcastle fans. That was a history-making win, and it was just it was beautiful.
Great fun.
And the pettiness factor, and I know we come on this later on, but also to have beaten Aston Villa on Boxing Day for Newcastle fans, and that sort of rivalry which has emerged over the last 15, 20 years, it's been quite the week in terms of getting one over on those top teams.
It certainly has. Quick starts and early goals have been a bit of a trademark for Newcastle recently. Alexander Isak given the freedom of the penalty area, a lovely Bruno pass and Lewis Hall cross. George got Newcastle on their way nice and early, and a great goal.
Downward header, unmarked. He's got in between the two of the Man United centre-halves, Maguire and Martinez, and it could hardly have been more straightforward for him. It was a slightly deflected cross from Lewis Hall, but even so, criminal, just to give him that amount of space in the area. And I think there are a lot of reasons why Newcastle have had this uptick in form that's been so dramatic, but Isak is certainly emblematic of it. I mean, talking about Happy New Year, he wants to say Happy Old Year to everybody. He can't want 2024 to end. He scored in every game in December. And, you know, that electric run of form predates Newcastle's kind of recovery a little bit, but it's definitely emblematic of it. Just phenomenal. He had a great chance not too long afterwards.
Oh, and he did.
He tried to sort of dink the ball above the keeper when if he'd gone for power, surely you'd have scored.
It's a recurring theme, isn't it, those one-on-ones?
Yeah.
I think he has one a game, doesn't he, where he gets a really great chance and he seems to fluff his lines. But maybe he's being slightly too cool for school, I think, maybe he's on last night when he should just put his laces through it.
Yeah, he's such a kind of beautiful player to watch, so kind of fluid. It's almost like he has too much time to do something special in those moments, and it kind of, you know, could perhaps trust his instincts. But it's 25 Premier League goals in 2024. I know we talk about this every pod, or we have done in the last few weeks, yeah. But that means that only Alan Shearer has beaten that total in a calendar year for Newcastle. And it's 12 goals in 13 fixtures in all competitions. And, you know, they've needed him. You know, he said himself that he's been trying to get more headers. You know, you want to see him get scruffy goals as well as the beautiful world-class ones, but he's, you know, he's absolutely becoming the player that I confidently predicted he would be in the summer. He's gone up another level in terms of prolific scoring. He's just a fantastic player, and he's ours. Hands off.
He's now level, if not quite as good as Shola Amiobi in terms of Premier League goals for Newcastle United as well, I believe, or goals, maybe goals in general for Newcastle United. So, you know, he's reached the Amiobi level.
What's the comparison in games played for that, though, Chris? Because surely it must be quite a lot more for Shola.
I mean, just a few more. But Man United's three centre-backs could have afforded Alexander Isak a little bit more space in the six-yard box after 4 minutes to allow him to head the ball in. I mean, it was quite incredible that the three centre-backs and none of them anywhere near him. But to reiterate the point about it being an early goal, that's one thing that really has changed for Newcastle over the last few weeks and has helped transform their form. Because in five of the last six games across all competitions, they've scored inside the opening 12 minutes. And I mean, in the last couple of matches.
And that's astonishing.
They've been very, very, yeah, it is. I mean, the last few, they've been very, very early as well.
Yeah.
And Newcastle are very good front runners. They certainly have been this season, haven't lost when they've taken the lead in a match. They've only dropped, I think, 3 points when they have done. 4 points, sorry, when they have done. So they're very good when they get ahead. And certainly when they get ahead early, that tends to be, that builds the confidence and they grow from it. And certainly the way that they are playing at the moment. But just on Isak, actually, the best thing I thought he did last night was the pass that he played through for Lewis Hall, for the Lewis Hall's shot in the second half.
Unbelievable.
The fact that that is clearly deliberate, yeah. The way that he sort of manoeuvres his foot to play what is like a daisy cutter sort of pass through perfectly.
It was ruler straight as well, wasn't it? It had no spin, yeah. No swerve or nothing. It just went in an exact straight line. It was incredible.
And that's where I think, and we've said this before, but that's where I think that sets him apart from other strikers, yeah. Really, other forwards, because he can do so much more. He's adding, as George said, the sort of scruffy goals, adding far more of them. One-on-ones, I think it's probably the one-on-one issue, I think, is almost, I don't know if he just overthinks it, and he's just someone who, he's always a yard ahead of the defender anyway, yeah. So to almost have that extra time, it's become sort of psychological for him, because I don't think it was really an issue maybe last season or the season before. But anyway, that's something which he can certainly iron out. And if you imagine if he added those goals, and he's also had, I think, 3 or 4 goals ruled out this season, rightly, but ruled out for various different reasons. So basically, he could and should have had probably more than 30 Premier League goals across this calendar year, and he's still only 25. It's frightening how good he could become if he continues on this trajectory.
George, Joe Linton's had a proper smashing Christmas, hasn't he? He's really enjoyed the festive period. Got on the score sheet again yesterday. A touch of handball maybe about this one? It was checked and it was cleared.
Well, it was checked, it was cleared. It's his upper arm. I mean, I don't think anybody knows what the handball rule is anymore, law is anymore. I don't. But he was just using his upper body strength, wasn't he?
A bit of a mismatch, wasn't it? Him jumping against Martinez as well.
I
thought Martinez, I was surprised he wasn't a bit more physical. For a man who gets called the butcher, he didn't really put himself about very much, did he?
Yeah, I mean, to nobody's surprise, Joe Linton comes straight back into the side after the Ipswich win. Impressive, though, that was. And he's picked up where he left off. He's just such a important player for Newcastle. And on nights like that against Man United, against the team who were struggling for confidence, who were struggling for any kind of fluency, who were struggling to put passes together, having that kind of physical, aggressive player to go with the skill of Tonali and Guimaraes in midfield, Man United could not live with any aspect of that. And Joe Linton was terrific.
The Geordie boys as well, they were taking the piss, Chris, at times, weren't they? They could have been 4-0 up by 25 minutes into the game. Tonali hit the post, a beautiful move, which would have been a glorious goal if that had gone in.
Yeah, I mean, by the 25th minute, already the Newcastle United away end, all 3,000 Geordies who were there, were already singing, "This is the best trip I've ever been on." And because by that stage, it was actually, and I say this as someone who obviously wanted to see Newcastle win and was glad in the context, but it was actually borderline uncomfortable being in the stadium after about 20, 25 minutes, because it was like, this is not a contest. This is painful to watch how bad Man United are and how good Newcastle had been up to that stage. Now, in the end, the scoreline was far closer than that half an hour reflected, and that it really should have been. Newcastle should have been out of sight, and Tonali, who was excellent, as were the midfield in general. And that was the big gaping chasm, really, between the two teams.
Chasm.
The wrong word, yes. The wrong word. We'll just move on from that.
It's the right word.
We're not just going to move on,
right,
Chris.
Word. It's just you've pronounced it incorrectly. It's the right chasm. Word. Chasm is the right word. It's just you meant chasm.
Yes. So it was the wrong
Good
word.
Good Lord.
That's the right word. No, it's the right word. You've just you put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Anyway.
Is this a two Ronnie sketch?
Anyway, I mean, when the team sheet came out, I turned to Laurie Whitwell, who covers Man United for The Athletic, and sort of said, why is he playing Eriksen and Casemiro together? Are they not both really old? Are they not really both quite slow?
Combined age of 68.
Yeah, well, he's like, they don't really have anyone else. And I was like, well, they've got Maino on the bench. And he said, yeah, but Kobbie Maino hasn't been playing particularly well. I'm thinking, yeah, but it was just bizarre to have those two, even just to have two against Newcastle's three, to me, seems like a bizarre decision. But to make it those two in particular, the way that they were danced around, both of them.
Yeah.
Both of the goals came from originally Newcastle dominating in midfield and Bruno Guimaraes spreading the ball out wide. And certainly for the second one, the way that it's just like a simple 1-2 in midfield, just in the middle of in the centre circle, cuts out Christian Eriksen. And Bruno had already nicked the ball off him earlier on to send Isak through for that 1-on-1 on the edge of his own area. And it was like men against boys. It was genuinely just, it was embarrassing to see that gulf. That's not to take away from how magnificent Newcastle's midfield operated, because you've got the power of Joe Linton. Because even when Kobbie Maino came on and was sort of, that solidified Man United to a certain extent and changed the dynamics slightly, there was still one moment where Joe Linton literally brushed past Maino and like shrugged him to one side. And it was just that sort of physical element that he brings, the ability to carry that arriving in the box and scoring the goal. With Tonali, both the reading of space and one touch, two touch passing, getting the ball forward, dictating play. And then Bruno Guimaraes basically just roaming and just probing and causing so many problems. I mean, I think that was Bruno's best game for Newcastle in a long, long time. Yeah. He was excellent. He was allowed to be excellent, he was excellent, certainly in that first half.
The Xerxes substitution, George, has been heavily criticised for the potential impact on the player, but it did make a change to the game, didn't it? It totally changed the dynamic, and Man United slowly started to come back into it.
When you're watching a game like that, you do sometimes have that sense of a trapdoor opening beneath another team. I mean, it's usually us, you know, in my memory, it's like, and for them, you know, it is kind of astonishing to hear the crowd respond the way they were, to see the team unable to respond in any way, shape or form. And yeah, pretty sad to see a player. He went straight down the tunnel and then came back out again onto the bench. And Man United improved when Maino came on. They could not have got any worse. I mean, I can't see how they could have got any worse. My fear at half time, if that's the right word, I don't think it was. I think I was stupefied basically by what I'd seen. But, you know, the fear, the lingering bit of concern was that Newcastle hadn't put the game quite out of sight. And in the last 5-10 minutes of that half, it was like they had sort of thought to themselves, well, we don't need to be in fifth gear here. We can get through this game in third gear. And they'd sort of lessened off a bit. And yeah, if Man United had sort of taken one of those chances that they had, it might have ended up a bit differently, except that I think that Newcastle probably could have gone up another gear again. I mean, I think that was the thing about that performance. Astonishing to see a Man United player come off for tactical reasons after 30 minutes or so and for Newcastle to be the cause of it. But as Chris said, they were just being run rings around in midfield. There was a a real, real goof, a real chasm.
Yes, there was, absolutely. Newcastle didn't play amazing in that second half, Chris, did they? But they managed the game well, and Kieran Trippier and Bruno were being quite canny at times.
They managed the game well eventually. I thought the first 15 minutes of the second half, they allowed to drift too much and allowed Man United to get back into it. And obviously Maguire hits the post. And if Man United had got that goal, they did feel like the momentum was starting to shift a little bit, and the home crowd were getting louder. And if that, given what has happened previously to Newcastle there, there was sort of that trepidation, but eventually they did manage it better. It was odd because Newcastle had 10 shots before Man United had a single shot. I think Man United's first one was in the 34th minute.
Yeah.
And then in the second half, Newcastle only actually had one shot, which was Lewis Hall's, went across the bar. It was sort of midway through, it was about the 68th minute. So it was very different second half, but sort of from the hour mark onwards, it was almost as if you could have blown the whistle then. Man United didn't really ever look like scoring other than they had, I think it was one chance from a corner, which they headed wide. Newcastle didn't really offer any threat going forward. It was almost like, yeah, we'll sort of see this game out. And I was slightly surprised that Howe didn't make a few substitutions earlier, because I thought some Newcastle players were looking a bit tired. Gordon had run himself in the ground, a few other players had, but eventually the substitution maybe aided Newcastle later on, but yeah, really it was a sort of non-event for the final half an hour.
And producer Ollie's reluctant to put in a talking point about Martin Dubravka, because Brentford scored immediately after Ollie posted a positive comment about him on social media. But if Martin Dubravka is away in January, George, this is a nice little run for him, isn't it? He's looked quite assured.
Well, I mean, more than that. I mean, it's pretty astonishing to think that, you know, Nick Pope comes out of the team after that traumatic 4-2 defeat at Brentford. What happened last season when Nick Pope came out of the team? Newcastle really, really struggled. They couldn't keep clean sheets. The differential in stats between Pope playing and Dubravka playing were really, really stark. They were kind of highlighted all the time. Martin Dubravka has kept four consecutive clean sheets in the Premier League. Stunning. I think they said on Sky that that is the only time a Premier League goalkeeper has done that in 2024.
Wow.
Now, one thing I would say is that he's not had to work too hard. I mean, I don't think we're looking at those games as a big, long list of man of the match performances from Martin Dubravka, because he's not had to do that. I think there are probably a lot of reasons for that. The defence has obviously been playing very well. I think the protection that Tonali is giving the defence is something that we didn't see last season, been very apparent as well. But no, he's absolutely played his part, done his bit. One thing that Chris has pointed out to me repeatedly when we've discussed Dubravka is the fact that he looks a lot more comfortable with his feet now. And I think that is something that's kind of quite noticeable about these run of games. But no, a great moment for him to go back to Old Trafford, where he was, of course, on loan. And, you know, had a tough time there. His future at Newcastle didn't look very assured, but he's come into the team and he's absolutely done what's been asked of him. So if this is the end, we'll have to see. But, I mean, that's a stunning turnaround from last season, isn't it?
It certainly is.
It is. I mean, just picking up on the point that George made about Dubravka with his feet, I also think that that's added a fresh dimension to the way Newcastle can play. And it's interesting to see that maybe we thought sooner that maybe the way Newcastle would try to evolve, that Nick Pope is a wonderful shot stopper and he's very, very good at clearing up outside of his box in terms of coming up and sweeping, but he's not certain. I mean, he's probably the worst goalkeeper with his feet in the Premier League. And it's sort of that weird positive negative you have with having him in goal. And it is the next evolution for Newcastle that they bring in someone, be it James Trafford or the like, to be the goalkeeper who can play a bit more with their feet going forward and add that fresh dimension to be almost like an additional outfield player. Now on Dubravka, I think that he's an interesting case in point looking at the January window in terms of someone who basically almost encapsulates where Newcastle are as a club as to what they can and can't do, because Dubravka's heading into the final 6 months of his contract. He's in his mid-30s now. He's almost certainly not going to get another contract. But he's currently Newcastle's number one because Nick Pope is injured. I asked Howe about it a couple of weeks ago and he basically said, we can't let him, why would we let our goalkeeper who's playing every week go at the moment? Whereas I think there's some people at Newcastle who are minded to potentially towards the back end of January, if Nick Pope's fit, potentially let him go. That will get, though it's not going to be massive PSR wise, but it gets his wages off the books. He's someone's going to leave anyway. Theoretically, you have, you do have Greece's number one goalkeeper in Odysseus Flakodimos there who could come back. There's another four goalkeepers beyond Martin Dubravka at the club, but really Eddie Howe would actually like another goalkeeper signed because he isn't fully confident in necessarily the understudies he has in Nick Pope. He has never been fully confident realistically about Dubravka as a shot stopper as well. And yet they're almost in a catch-22 situation where it's like nobody wants to move first in terms of what Newcastle can do because there are so many knock-on effects and people are almost entrenched in their positions. That's not to say that this is a negative point behind the scenes. This isn't causing a point of tension necessarily. It just sort of shows that every single decision Newcastle are making in the transfer market is very, very difficult because it basically has a knock-on effect for what they can do in coming and outgoing, and then it does the same for future windows as well.
When's Nick Pope due to be back?
Middle to end of January, but even that possibly could be a bit ambitious.
I mean, there you go. I mean, if you're Martin Dubravka, you've been thinking about your future and maybe moving on somewhere else, possibly this month. You've now got a League Cup semi-final, and the second leg of the League Cup semi-final is the 5th of February.
Yeah, haven't been cup tied previously when Newcastle were at the final. Obviously, famously, not only is Nick Pope suspended, then Martin Dubravka was cup tied.
Of course, that's right. Yeah.
Well, he has a Man United winner.
He does. In the words of Cool and the Gang, Chris, celebrate good times. Come on, a nice big party in the away end. They were in fine voice, weren't they? The travelling mags.
There were, there were very vocal. I hear from people who watch on TV that you could hear them throughout, and certainly within the ground, you could. It almost felt like on the PA they were trying to turn up the volume because Newcastle fans were trying to sing louder than it, and they were singing throughout. But then, obviously, as I said, after 25 minutes, they're already singing about this being the best trip they've ever been on, and then sort of age old favourites whenever they play Man United are doing well came out. So there was Who's That Team We Call United, which Newcastle also tweeted when they sent out their dressing room photo. That's after right, the game, the victory dressing room photo. There's also You've Seen United. Now F off form, obviously, as they always sing. But then there was a fresh ditty, which I really enjoyed this one, was the sort of like say hello to Sunderland in the second half. It basically was then added to with the fact that then Ruben Amorim, having been asked on TV as to whether Man United were in a relegation battle, sort of basically confirmed that he thought that they are. And so it was almost like it almost added credence to this piss taking that there was in the away end. So yeah, it was very, very much celebratory mood. And rightly so, and understandably so, and Newcastle's players sort of played up to that. I mean, Bruno Guimaraes kicked the ball off Diogo Dalot in added time and sort of like celebrated as if he'd scored a goal. And then he went and did exactly the same, stayed behind after Jason Tindall had sort of pushed all the players forward towards the away end to celebrate. Bruno stayed behind afterwards and did his scream towards them and sort of that acknowledgement back and forth.
Yes.
So yeah, it was very much celebrating. And rightly so, because just go back to all of those stats about going to Old Trafford. I mean, even regardless, just seeing the team perform like that in the first half an hour, but also seeing the run of form that Newcastle have been on after at times testing 2024, it was very, very much a time to celebrate. And I'm glad that the players embraced that for a little bit. Obviously, they have to then switch focus and move on, and all of them are talking afterwards about being humble and focusing on the next game. And that's obviously what Eddie Howe was saying, and rightly from their perspective, but also just to sort of live in that moment for a second and put themselves in Newcastle fan seats, because Howe talked about using the pain of that. They knew the pain that this fixture was associated with for Newcastle fans.
We can't forget that win against Aston Villa, George, on Boxing Day as well. It feels like it was a lifetime ago now, but it wasn't that long ago at all. Crucial 3 points against arguably a rival for those European places. That start, Anthony Gordon, what a goal. Possibly his best in a black and white shirt.
Yes, I'd like to turn to Chris Woff, who'd like to give you a quick update on the goal Aston Villa scored.
Well, just on that, if we are talking about the way Newcastle's midfield,
No, Chris, I don't want to talk you to talk about how Newcastle's midfield blended together. I don't want you to talk about the chasm that there was between Newcastle's team and Aston Villa's team. I want you to describe the goal, so then I can make the point that I want to make.
Anthony Gordon's goal?
Yes.
Well, it was Tonali and Bruno won the ball in midfield, but Tonali won it twice in 30 seconds, and then it was played forward to Joe Linton, who spread it wide to Anthony Gordon, who cut in on his right foot and then whipped a lovely finish into the top right-hand corner.
Beautiful. So one of the things that I did want to mention, thanks Chris, one of the things that I did want to talk about is how Newcastle have kind of played the right teams at the right time. It certainly felt during this run of games. I mean, I'm not diminishing what they've done, because they've done superbly and they end the year in absolutely fantastic form. But just as, you know, when they played against Leicester and they played against a team who did absolutely what Newcastle wanted them to do, who set up in a way that allowed Newcastle to make the most of their attributes at a time when they were groping for confidence. Ipswich, again, so naive in the way they set up against Newcastle and Man United last night. But Villa, whose record at St James's is terrible, and I think we're on a run of something like four away defeats in a row, absolutely lived up to that. And they were appalling. Just as Newcastle have found it difficult to go to Old Trafford, Villa have got this allergy to St James's Park. And it lasted, and incredibly, it lasted all the way through the Mike Ashley era. I don't know, Newcastle were allergic to winning at all, you know, during that period. And Villa somehow managed not to win at St James's. You had to go back to that incredible three sending off match for them for their last win there. And they just played like that. It was another absolutely hilarious match. Newcastle started brilliantly. The confidence comes through. And then, of course, there's the daft sending off that changes everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just before that, I want to slightly disagree with George in the sense that I thought Villa were bad for about 5-10 minutes. And actually, for the next 15-20 minutes, they started to get a foothold in the game without really actually creating many clear-cut chances. That Dinia's free kick, which Dubravka saved relatively comfortably. But I thought that territory-wise, possession-wise, they were starting to build into the game before the Duran red card. So I disagree slightly that they did start very badly, but it wasn't the same as like Man United. It wasn't like an extended be terrible.
No. I agree. I think, you know, there were two turning points. There was the Gordon goal and then there was a sending off. But Unai Emery talked about how terribly they'd started, and they did. I mean, they were shocking. The game was lost in those two moments, but one led to the other. Gordon's goal was deserved. Newcastle started brilliantly and Villa weren't able to live with it. They grew into it, but by that point, they were chasing the game.
And John Duran saw red, both literally and figuratively speaking. Was it harsh, this one, Chris? What's your take on this?
I may be in the minority here. I did think it was harsh. I get the fact that it was reckless, and so I can see the argument you could make that
was it dangerous?
Possibly. I think the problem that I've got is that it wasn't... Often when you say that someone should be sent off for reckless rather than intent, it's because it's the first action that you do. So maybe you come off your feet, or your both feet come off, or the way that you make a challenge. He sort of barges and shoves into Cher, which then leads to what happens next, which is how he lands on him. But if you don't think that he deliberately lands on him, then A leading to B isn't necessarily that A would always led to B. And so I think it's hot. The way I look at it is if he has done it deliberately, he's stupid, because if you're going to do it deliberately, surely you do it properly. I don't see how you could do that and think, this isn't going to get picked up. So if he really hasn't caught him, certainly with both feet properly, it's a weird sort of action, the way that he falls. But to me, it didn't look like it was full force. And therefore, if he's done it, he is properly stupid, because if you're going to do it, surely you just properly do it.
I thought he did it, but I don't think he fully committed. I think what happened was, Shea caught him when Shea fell backwards, cleared the ball out and fell back, and his studs were up and he caught him in the midriff. And I think Duran just lost the plot, because he was already up a height after the free kick that he wasn't allowed to take, like some kind of schoolboy. And I think he's thought, I'm going to nobble him here, I'm going to do him. And then he's kind of backed out at the last second. Obviously, he rolls his ankle as well, doesn't he? They showed that on Match of the Day. He kind of rolled his ankle. But just before that, he'd already stepped on the back of Shea's left leg. Intentional or not, I don't know. But he stepped on the back of his left leg, and then the right foot comes round. Now, to me, I think, looking at it at full speed and at slow motion, I think he can get out the way of that. I don't think he has to do that. I think it's totally needless.
No, I get that. I do see
and
that.
And I think it's reckless, and I think it's a bit dangerous as well. But I think he's just lost the plot, basically.
Maybe. I mean, the thing is, we are talking, you know, ultimately you're talking about a split second, and it's so difficult to put yourself in someone else's brain to know what goes through it in that absolute moment, and whether you change your mind halfway through. I mean, Chris and I have been sort of arguing with Luke Edwards, one of our mates, who writes the Telegraph, and he said from you know, the moment that happened, that was a dreadful challenge, deserved red card. I didn't, whether it was harsh or not, I don't know. I just didn't think it was as clear cut as that. And I think the fact we're still arguing about
probably
it
says everything, doesn't it?
Says everything. What I would say, though, is that once it's given, that is never going to be overturned.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, I think that was the right decision, not to overturn it once it's been given on the pitch. I don't understand what Unai Emery was talking about, saying that the referee should have delayed and consulted VAR, because that's not how it works. The referee had to make a decision.
Yeah,
and VAR intervenes, and I don't think there was enough in it. The fact is, they've appealed. It's been ratified, the sending off. So, you know.
And Duran's now been... being charged with misconduct as well for his behaviour on the way off the pitch, kicking water bottles around and generally throwing his toys out the pram, which is fair enough, I think.
Yeah.
Things really got out of hand at half-time, though, Chris, didn't they? And no prizes for guessing who was involved in that.
Free Jason Tindall. I think this is that's libelous, what you've just said there, Taylor. Libelous. Yeah, I mean, during the first half, it was... I actually think it might have been Eddie Howe who sort of had riled... Weirdly, it'd actually been the one who railed Unai Emery first, because he'd complained about a decision that had been given on the field, and then Emery didn't like it, and then I think Tindall said something back to him, and then Emery spent most of the rest of the first half telling the fourth official that Jason Tindall had to get out of the technical area and move back, and so there was sort of argy bargy between the two of them, lots of words spoken, and then
I mean, we Unai Emery's a grass, is that what you're saying, Chris?
Well, it certainly looked like it from where we were sitting.
He was asked afterwards about being so angry and animated in the first half, and his kind of reply was, yeah, in the first half. It's like, yeah, but you were really angry. Why were you so angry? I was angry in the first half, wasn't I? What about after that? No, you seemed a bit less angry in the second half, but I'm asking about the first half. Yes, I was angry in the first half. It's like, what's changed? Of course, what had changed was Newcastle's captain Creosote, the shithouser in chief, King Troll, Jason Tindall had departed the scene, albeit not without a little more argy-bargy on the way.
But I mean, when you mentioned what happened in the tour, I mean, we didn't know about that. We didn't know initially that Tindall had been sent off until it was actually you who informed us, Taylor. You messaged George, and then we asked Newcastle's press officer, went and found out, and they still didn't know exactly what had happened there. And then on Amazon Prime coverage, Howe was asked about a sort of they mentioned there was a potential 20-man melee. Now, Howe was then asked about that in his press conference. And weirdly, because it's very un-Howe, like, usually you would just sort of bat that off and just not go... Howe was... he basically confirmed it. And then whether he thought it was a way of sort of, like, helping Jason Tindall's defence or what, I don't know. He was like, oh, well, yeah, I mean 16 or 17 or 18 people were sort of involved. Like, what? He's like, but it's one of those ones where it looks like, you know, actually there's only a couple of people involved and other people are trying to split it up, so it looks like there's more people involved. And you're thinking, is he trying to make out that everyone was involved? So if the FA tried to bring charges, they would have to bring out charges against everyone. Yeah. I mean, it was all rather odd. And so we don't know the full ins and outs. Now, from part of the Villa side afterwards, they were trying to argue that Tindall basically went for Unai Emery, and then that side, they were trying to argue that it was from the Newcastle side. Newcastle insiders sort of argue the opposite, and they basically say it was all instigated by Emery and his backroom staff, and the Villa analyst, who was also sent off at half-time, and the fourth official and the referee agree with them. I mean, we are still waiting for the referee's report to come out, and almost certainly there will be charges brought, you would have thought, to both clubs, but it'll be interesting to see in the referee's report how the full thing is described and what exactly, at least from the referee's account and the other official's account, actually happened at half-time in that tunnel. But yeah, it's certainly...
I was just going to say, incredibly briefly, the fact that we're talking about Jason Tindall again shows that Newcastle United are back, surely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, we've missed this. And obviously you don't want... people fighting and things like that, but a little bit of shushing and shithousery on the touchline, we know that that's our Newcastle United. So hopefully they're back for good.
And then coming out after the game wearing a Wham hoodie with a picture of himself and Eddie Howe on the front of it, which is absolutely beautiful. Brilliant.
Yeah.
But it was fascinating at Old Trafford, because we'd reported the day after the game that although Tindall had been sent off, it isn't automatic that he gets a touchline ban.
Right,
basically, there's an investigation. So others had gone elsewhere and then report that later on. But Tindall didn't actually appear at the start of the match, but on the touchline at Old Trafford, to think, oh, maybe we got this wrong. And then he spotted that he was actually sat in among the substitutes on the bench, and he didn't get up until about the 20th minute. So I don't know if he deliberately is sort of trying to temper his sort of appearance on the touchline while the investigation is ongoing. Good behaviour.
Very possibly. Villa then drew on the 30th of December with a last-minute equaliser from Brighton. So Newcastle are up to fifth in the league. And if anything, George, they're looking up, not down.
Yeah, which is astonishing, really. You just go back to the, you go back to that Brentford away game, the 4-2 defeat. You know, Chris was there for that, and he spoke afterwards about how sort of deflated Howe looked in his press conference afterwards. And they were 12th on the table. To, I mean, I don't think any of us really seriously thought that they would be in the Champions League conversation by this point in time, but they are. They found a way forward. The team looks so much better, looks so much balanced, more balanced. Tonali looks fantastic, found a way of working. Isak full of goals. We do have a couple of little worries about defence now with injuries and so on and so forth, but it's just been a brilliant recovery. It's something that we're going to write about this week, how they've got to where they are. But yeah, just it's just been a fabulous December.
And I think it's worth underlining again the sort of stark contrast between the pre this run and the current run. I mean, Newcastle won 2 of 11 games before that Leicester match. It wasn't as if they'd just hit a rocky patch. It was an extended period where they were struggling and they didn't look like they were scratching around in terms of ideas. And yet instead they've gone on this 5-match winning run. They scored 21 goals across December, having struggled to score goals earlier in the campaign. They managed to get 21 goals across December. As George said, 4 successive top flight clean sheets, 360 minutes since they conceded a goal in the Premier League, which was an injury time, added time at Brentford. Yes. 4 straight league wins for the first time since April 2023, which was obviously the season that Newcastle did qualify for the Champions League. And since the start of November, only Liverpool with 23 points and Nottingham Forest with 21 have claimed more points than Newcastle's 20 across the course of that month. So that's how different a position they are in over the course of the last 2 months. Newcastle have nearly trebled their points tally.
Amazing. Right, chaps, let's have a quick break. But before we do, riddle me this. Our producer, Ollie, 43 years old, has been to watch Newcastle at Old Trafford 4 times. He has seen us achieve 3 wins and a draw, yet he wasn't at the Johan Cabaye game in 2013. How is this possible? Answer after the break.
I'd eat war, kid.
Right then, chaps, welcome back. Anyone get the answer to the quiz?
Well, if it's 3 wins, so last night was one of them.
Yep.
Last season in the League Cup, and then there were FA Cup ties at at Old Trafford, weren't they? And I'm trying to think, the only one that I can think of was the late 90s, I can't remember what year, 98 or 99, and Sheffield United.
Sheffield United and Spurs was the other one, wasn't it? Spurs in the semi-final?
Oh, Spurs.
And Shearer scored that raker into
the top corner. That...
Yeah.
So he wasn't at Sheffield United.
Yeah, Spurs in 1999. He wasn't at the Sheffield United game. So yes,
right. I have a quick quiz and response.
Oh, come on, then. Oh God!
Well, you are.
Is it quick?
It is quick. Yeah, it's just that Isak has scored in 6 successive games. Who are the other Newcastle players to have done that? In
Joe Willock got 7, didn't he? 7 successive games.
Joe Willock, got to 7.
Yeah, that was successive appearances rather than games, but it does count. Okay. Yeah.
Did he beat Cole? Was it Cole? Andy Cole?
Not Andy Cole, no.
Alan Shearer?
Shearer's level with Willock, and then there's one other player who got 6. So they both got 7, so Isak needs another 1 to...
And there's one other player?
...level with them. Although, as I say, they weren't... Neither Shearer's nor Willock's were in consecutive games. They were in successive appearances for those players, whereas Isak's have been in all successive games. But there's one other player.
Les Ferdinand?
Nope.
Papi Cissé.
Yes, Papi Cissé had a very, very...
Oh, of course. That's...
...strong purple patch when he first arrived, not long after he arrived. He
was... Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Amazing.
Just call me Quizmaster Colkin.
Into 2025, chaps. And thanks to Chris for that interruption. That was very handy in disturbing the neat link that we had for Spurs. Well done to you.
That's what I'm here for.
Spurs, Saturday lunchtime, TNT Sports. We love an early kickoff, don't we, lads? That's what it's all about, isn't it? Playing football and practically in the AM. Absolute nonsense.
Early games, come on.
Is this another case of a right team at the right time, George?
Well, it feels like it, doesn't it? I mean, that's the death knell for it, isn't it? That's the kiss of death.
It is.
Yes, that is the kiss of death. But, you just look at Spurs' run of form, that incredible daft 6-3 defeat at home to Liverpool. They've lost at Forest. There was their late equaliser for Wolves on the 29th. Yeah, they look to be all over the place. So they're there to be taken advantage of. that, of course, makes me feel very nervous. But why should it after Old Trafford?
Yes, absolutely. Ange's philosophy as well, Chris. He seems to be sticking to his guns in the face of a bit of a defensive crisis.
Very stubborn, and you can say that's got him to where he has in his career, and he believes in that, and fair enough. But at the moment, it certainly doesn't look pretty, and we've mentioned it before about having Fraser Forster in goal and asking him to play in a certain way, which clearly he isn't comfortable and accustomed to doing so. So yeah, Newcastle go there with a heck of a lot of confidence, and given the defensive problems and defensive selection issues that Postecoglou's Spurs have, I think Newcastle should fancy their chances there. Now, it is a difficult challenge still, because in some ways Spurs will very much suit Newcastle, because Spurs, if they do play the way that they always play, then that gives Newcastle space. That gives them opportunities to both attack and counter-attack. But Spurs do score goals, so Newcastle's recent defensive solidity is likely to be tested far more sternly than maybe it has been in recent weeks, and Martin Dubravka will actually need to make some saves, I would have thought, for Newcastle to make sure they leave North London with a positive result.
Speaking of defensive issues as well, Fabian Scher picked up yellow cards against Brentford in the Cup and Man United in the league, so he's going to miss both of those games in the next week. Spurs and Arsenal, George, you'll be a big miss.
Well, he certainly will, because you look at Newcastle's record, it's four clean sheets in a row in the league, and Scher's played a big part in that, of course. And yeah, it's one area of the pitch that Newcastle have been looking to strengthen for a while now. We know that Sven Botman is coming back towards fitness, but I think these games will come too soon for him, and he's left-sided anyway. Emil Kraft is still injured, so it means there's no kind of natural, obvious solution for Eddie Howe in these matches. You would think it means Lloyd Kelly coming back into the team.
Yeah.
He's not had an easy time of things so far for Newcastle since his move in the summer. So, yeah, it's a great shame. Scher is still very influential, and he will be a big miss.
He certainly will. On Arsenal on that Tuesday night, Chris, the first leg of the semi-final, a bit of a rest for the wicked. We have that Spurs fixture on Saturday, but the Gunners still have two games to play, Brentford at home and then a tea time trip to Brighton on Saturday. So that plays into Newcastle hands quite nicely.
Yeah, and I mean, Arsenal have obviously had a far more congested fixture list up to this stage throughout the season, because they're competing in the Champions League and have the additional fixtures. So that may be a slight advantage, but Arsenal are also used to playing a significant number of matches. So I think more the sort of tiredness and fatigue really plays more of a factor when a side is struggling a little bit. I think it's something which you can play through more if you just bounce on to the next game, is what, if you speak to footballers, and that's what they say. If you're winning matches, you just want the next one to come. Whereas if you feel those sorts of the fatigue and the little niggles a lot more if you're struggling a little bit. So I think both sides are in pretty good form, so I don't think that should be a massive factor, but it might just be a slender advantage there for Newcastle.
And Arsenal are injury hit, apparently, George. Bukayo Saka out for possibly the rest of the season. Ben White and Tomiyasu are other longer-term concerns. But it's hardly a crisis, though, is it, with the quality they have in their squad?
Call that an injury list.
I know.
I mean, you know, come back. Let's go back
three
to
three players.
Let's go back to Leicester. Three, call that an injury list.
Pathetic.
Come back to me when you have to name the same midfield three for 95 games in a row.
And one of them's a child.
And one of them's a child, yeah. I mean, Saka's a huge miss. He's absolutely a world-class player. He's fantastic to watch. He's very, very influential to the way that Arsenal play, of course. So Newcastle will have to try and make the most of it.
Saka and Odegaard are absolutely their key players, Chris. It'll be interesting to see how they deal with it without Bukayo Saka. I'm sure Odegaard will be difficult for Newcastle to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, since Odegaard came back into the team, they've scored a heck of a lot more goals. They were struggling with that creativity when he was out. Saka is similar in some ways to Newcastle losing someone like Isak. I'm not exactly the same sort of player, but in terms of being that talismanic, being the sort of match winner for them. So it is a huge blow, even if it's only one player they're losing. And he is sort of the difference maker for them. But they've got a deep squad. Jesus is back scoring a lot of goals. This is...
Oh, word, yes, he is.
I mean, George wouldn't let me make this point last week because he says it's irrelevant because the draw's already been made and it's immaterial. But I will still go back to the way that my brain works is I would rather it was Newcastle were at home first and to get the advantage first rather than try and go to the Emirates and get a decent result and then come back to St. James's Park and then build on that. That's just the way that my mind works. That's not the way that it's operating though. But Newcastle have to make sure they are still in this tie come the end of this match on Tuesday, because there's a month in between, and that really, I think, could weirdly, rather than when they played Southampton 2 years ago and it was only a week in between and there wasn't actually a game in between, a weird sort of quirk of the time, this could have a hangover effect in a positive or a negative sense. If they get a decent result, then it's something again to really build on. Whereas if it seems like they're out the tie already, then it's almost that they've got this extra fixture hanging out over them until the end of the month. And does that have a knock on effect for the league and maybe even the FA Cup? So I do think this game is huge in the context of what comes next for Newcastle.
I just think it's incredible you've got anything at all in your mind, Chris, when your body is made up of 89% mince.
What's the other 11%?
It's a chasm.
Is your gravy system being kept topped up over the Christmas, Chris, is it?
Oh, very much so, very much so. I did have a pigs and blanket stotty at lunchtime as well.
Of course he did. Of course he did.
Yeah, of course.
One unexpected annoyance. The authorities have deemed the semi-final an appropriate place to suddenly experiment with VAR in the EFL Cup. The results of VAR will be announced in stadium. An interesting one, this, Chris. What a time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite as outraged as other people about this, because I'm just used to the fact that VAR is in. I know it's not been in the FA Cup. It was actually weird in the quarter final, because there was a couple of moments where I think almost everyone in the stadium
waiting
expected something
court
to go to VAR, and it didn't. And it was. But I actually think this experiment potentially could be positive. Not the fact that it's been introduced in the semi final, but if going forward, announcements are going to be made in stadium, so people inside the ground actually know what's going on, rather than at the minute it's slightly better than it was before, but it's still like 2 minutes after the game's restarted, something comes up on the screen which people in the East Stand can't see. It's in St. James's Park telling them why a decision was given either way. It announcing it as well, for me, seems like it could be a positive move going forward.
Fair play. Right then, that's just about it, chaps. Our next pod will be after that Arsenal game. So if you were looking for a podcast on that Monday, it won't be out until the Wednesday after the Arsenal game.
George is doing the London doubleheader, because I can't face returning to the big smoke at the moment. I still haven't quite got over Brentford. So
yeah, what's changed since Brentford? It's like Chris has just decided never to go back to London again. And so I'm doing both, yeah. Such a sad sound.
He did, didn't he?
Oh, coming back from Brentford.
Yes, absolutely.
Can I just add that the Sandro Tonali produced one of my favourite moments of 2024 last night as well, was the fact that rather than be ruffled by and worried by the fact that the referee's in his way, he just decided to nutmeg him on the pitch.
He's that good.
That he could just nutmeg the referee as well.
Nutmeg the ref.
It was just such cool composure. So.
Incredible. Right then, chaps, that's it. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks, Chris.
You're very welcome. Happy New Year, everyone. See you in 2025, and hopefully Newcastle take this momentum far into the new year.
And thank you very much to you, George Culkin.
Well, hear to that. Maybe 2025 will finally be. No, okay, I won't say that out loud. But everyone has had a great time, and look forward to lots more to chat about in 2025.
Absolutely. Thank you to everybody who's listened to Pod on the Tyne in 2024. We really, really do appreciate your listenership. And if you've sent in a voice note or sent in an email and all that as well, it's all massively appreciated. So thank you. We hope you've had a good 2024, and we will see you next year. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.
Come on!
Athletic FC Podcast Network.